When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey guys, it's Albert. We got a great show coming for you this week. We got a panel coming in, two guests to help us break down a couple big off-season stories and the value of off-season programs within the fabric of the NFL. We got takeaways on Aaron Rodgers, Tim Tebow, the schedule release, Justin Fields, and rookie mini camps. And of course, we get to all of your questions in the six-pack. Let's go. All right, welcome in. It is the month of May. That means this is the supposed slow time in the NFL calendar. But as you guys know, things really never screech to a halt when it comes to the NFL. It's the Albert Breer Show. We got a fantastic show coming for you this week. We're going to try something a little different with our two guests that we have coming in. A cool panel that's going to address some big picture issues across the NFL and kind of give us some insight into what's going on in some of these locker rooms right now. With the quarterbacks, with the off-season program, all of that stuff. I think you guys are going to love it. We'll also get to your questions in the six-pack, but we'll start where we always do, and that's with the takeaways. And my first takeaway for this, the week of May 10th, 2021, I think the Aaron Rodgers situation is going to come down to the Packers' ability to effectively communicate with their quarterback. And to me, this is really about finding a working solution that's going to take some compromise. And I think this goes back to the way the Jordan Love pick was communicated to Aaron Rodgers. The fact that he had to find out about it the night of the draft, I think it would have made a world of difference if they had picked up the phone, Brian Gutekunst, Matt LaFleur, whoever it was, 2-3 days before the draft and just said, hey, listen, dude, there's a shot that we wind up taking a quarterback here. We like the Utah State kid. We potentially could trade up for him. We just want to let you know. I think finding out about it the way that he did, I think is a problem. I also think, you know, wanting to know the plan, wanting to at least be apprised of what's going on at 38 years old is a factor for Aaron Rodgers. And I think, you know, really, I think we have to listen to what Aaron's saying. I don't think anything happens by mistake. And I think, you know, in a certain way, and I've said this a few times in the show, the fact that he said what he said when he said it, right after the championship game, I think tells you that he was looking around and seeing how aggressively the other teams in that round had built those teams and how the Bills went out and they got, you know, Stephon Diggs for Josh Allen, how aggressively the Chiefs have built around Patrick Mahomes the last couple of years. And it's not just getting offensive weapons, veteran offensive weapons like Sammy Watkins. It's also going and fixing the defense in a very, very just urgent way and going getting Tyrann Mathieu and Frank Clark. And so I think Aaron Rodgers wants some of that. To me, the solution here has to come with, listen, dude, we're going to run it back for another year with the group that we have. And we are going to work forward now and start to build with more urgency, build the way the Bucs are building with Tom Brady. And like, we're going to build this around you for the next 2 or 3 years because we recognize that you are an all-time great. And we realize what you're up against down there in Tampa. And we realize that what you want is to get the most out of the years you have left playing football. We're going to do that for you. And so maybe the ship sailed on 2020, but giving him 2021, but giving him the promise that you'll do that if he continues to play into his 40s, I think would go a long way. And telling him we're going to communicate with you and we're going to give you some security that the job is going to be yours for the next 2 or 3 years and we're going to approve it with a contract, that I think would do some good. I just don't think it's going to be solved by the Packers saying, like, listen, we'll listen to you, but we're not changing the way we do business. I think at this point that's probably not going to be good enough. And I think that would only lead to this situation staying where it is, which is at this point at an impasse. Takeaway number two. To me, the Tim Tebow signing, in a vacuum, it isn't horrible. In a vacuum, it's a guy who's a really great athlete who's accomplished a lot of things on the fields of play, in different sports. who's got a relationship with the head coach, who can help sell the head coach's message. And it's a guy who wants to take one last shot at playing professional football while his body is still in the condition to do it. Totally get it. That part of it makes sense to me. I just don't know if it's worth it for Urban Meyer and the Jaguars. You know, I look at like the credibility issue this could create for Urban in his locker room. If Tebow looks, I mean, again, like, you know, he couldn't block me out there the first few days of camp. Like, this can't look like fantasy camp, right? And if it does and they don't get rid of him quickly, then I think it could create a little bit of a credibility problem where, you know, like, again, like so much of this stuff is about trust and making it a meritocracy and creating competition. Well, if Tebow isn't able to create competition, then I think that creates a little bit of a credibility problem with Meyer, given his relationship with Tebow. I also think the circus that comes with Tebow might not be worth it. And so, like, I look at these things and I just, like, what's the payoff? The guy's not going to turn into Tony Gonzalez or Rob Gronkowski. So is the payoff getting your message across the rest of the locker room or having a guy who can be your messenger in that locker room? Couldn't you get somebody else to do that? Like, I'm sure, like, Urban now is getting calls from other players who played for him at Florida or Ohio State that are on the fringe of the league asking for a shot because of this having happened. Like, couldn't one of those guys have been effective doing it? I mean, again, we're going to talk to our guests about this, but I don't know that a guy in the bottom of the roster is going to be the most effective messenger, you know, in trying to help establish your program. Takeaway number three, the schedule release is coming out on Wednesday night, or the schedule is coming out on Wednesday night. The schedule release will be held on Wednesday night. The schedule itself will trickle out over the course of the day on Wednesday. And, you know, my immediate thought here, and we're going to have a story on Thursday on the MMQB on the process of putting it together. My immediate thought is it must have been super difficult for guys like Ani Bose and Howard Katz, and the guys who put that schedule together every year. You don't know if the Packers are going to have Aaron Rodgers. For part of the time you were putting the schedule together, you didn't know if the Seahawks were going to have Russell Wilson. Like, you don't know who's going to be the starting quarterback in Chicago and New England. In San Francisco, there are so many questions because of all the quarterback movement. I'd imagine that was a very difficult job on top of the fact that you're going from 16 to 17 games and dealing with different circumstances than you've ever dealt with before. And what's so interesting about that part of it to me, you know, and I talked to a couple of guys over the weekend who told me that they went from, you know, in a 16 game schedule, which is 256 games, dealing with, like, the number of combinations is one, it has a single digit on the front of it and 20 zeros, whatever that is, quadrillion, quintillion, whatever, to now it being a 17-game schedule, 272 games, and it's a single digit with 40 zeros. So much more complex wading through it. And then, you know, getting the most attractive matchups is very, very difficult when there's been as much quarterback movement as there has been this offseason, and when some of those loose ends still haven't been tied up. Takeaway number four, after doing some digging around, you know, I think a lot of people were wondering, why isn't the league higher on Justin Fields? And I think the truth is a lot of the league was pretty high on Justin Fields. I told you guys on the show last week that there were a handful of teams that I talked to that didn't have a quarterback need, didn't have a pressing quarterback need, or weren't in position to draft a quarterback that basically, you know, conceded to me that they had Fields as the number two quarterback on the board above Zach Wilson, below Trevor Lawrence. And then you sort of start to sort through what some of the teams were doing in front of the 11th pick, which is where Justin Fields winds up going. So at seven, Detroit had a good offer for number seven. They wind up passing on it because Penei Sewell's there for him. At number eight, the Panthers. Their pick comes down to, internally, the best defensive player on their board, J.C. Horn or Justin Fields. They decide to stick with the methodical building process, go with J.C. Horn. Number nine, the Broncos. What do? Well, they're looking at either a quarterback, and Fields was the one they liked, or the best defensive player on their board. That's Patrick Surtain. They wind up going with Surtain. At 10, the Cowboys, right? They're sitting there. They didn't want to fall very far back. They really liked Micah Parsons. They knew if they went too far back, that'd be a problem. they found a suitor in the Eagles who, despite being in division, was going to allow them to make that short move back where they could pick up an extra pick. So the Eagles come up and hop over the Giants at 11 to grab Devontae Smith. Cowboys fall back two spots. And then, of course, we have the trade, the Giants coming up with the Bears, or the Bears coming up with the Giants to come and get Fields. So there you had, again, circumstances at 5, 6, and 7 leading to, and I think great players going in those spots, leading to those picks not moving, 4, 5, 6, and 7. And maybe less so 6, but the team at 6, Miami, had moved back up. So 4, 5, and 7, great players in those spots, great players go. 8 and 9, Fields was under consideration as the top quarterback left on the board. He gets traded up to at 11. I think if Washington had moved up for anybody, it probably would have been Fields. I think if the Saints had moved up for anybody, it would have been Fields. And you have those five teams I mentioned before that had Fields number two. A lot of people liked Fields. And I think his fall was circumstantial based on the makeup of the draft class. And I think the Bears walked away having like really pulled a coup to go up and get him at 11. Because I don't think in most draft years a player like Justin Fields would have been around at 11, which, good job, Ryan Pace. Good job, Matt Nagy. You got your guy. Finally, takeaway number 5. There were 3 rookie mini camps last weekend. There will be 29 more this coming weekend. Feel terrible for these rookies being caught up in this mess between the union and the league. And we're going to talk to our special guests about this. They're going to give us great insight on how necessary offseason programs are. But near perfect attendance last weekend. The Colts, of course, Sam Ellinger had an awful, like tragic situation in his family. His brother passed away. He wasn't there, but the rest of the Colts rookies were. Raiders, perfect attendance. Jets, perfect attendance. And I expect the same thing this coming weekend. And these rookies are being asked to stay away from mini camps when how many of those guys really have like a spot locked up, have their position on the roster locked up, have playing time locked up? I'd say almost none of them have playing time locked up. The majority of them don't even have a job, you know, like guaranteed. And so, you know, like for those guys who are trying to fulfill a dream, to ask them to stand down and not show up for a mini camp when it could put them behind the eight ball with their individual teams, I think that was a really tough ask. And so, you know, I think that it may have been better if the union had handled that by telling those guys, hey, look, like, it's okay if you guys show up. We understand. We're going to handle this as a veteran matter when we get to dealing with phase 2 and phase 3 of the offseason program. By the way, phase 2 of the offseason program starts on Monday, which is the start of walkthroughs. It's the start of on-field instruction from coaches to players. So it'll be really, really interesting to see what kind of attendance the 32 teams have at that. And we'll get to our special guests right after this. All right, well, we've had so many like quarterbacks people in here over the last few weeks and getting ready for the draft, and it feels like that's sometimes all we talk about. So I want to do something a little bit different this week, and so I'm going to kind of let the defense punch back a little bit here, and we're going to have a little bit of a linebacker podcast. And guys with much bigger necks than me are on the Zoom now. So I want to welcome in two guys who are good friends of mine, guys I've done work with. We've got former first-round pick, former Ohio State, Patriots, Lions, of course, Cowboys, Dolphins linebacker Bobby Carpenter, and then former second-round pick, I think, Ted, right? Like you're a second-rounder?
That's right. Right.
Former second-rounder and Super Bowl champion Patriot linebacker Ted Johnson. Welcome into the show, guys.
Good to be here. It's good to see you, Bobby. And
thank you, Albert.
Good to be with you, Bert, man.
Yeah. Okay, so
I appreciate it. See, the last time I – well, before we get in there, I mean, I when I got drafted into Dallas, they used to have put on the videos of Ted Johnson playing the stack defense and going down and smoking guards, and that was like our expectation of what we were going to have to be. So I had to watch this guy my entire rookie year, and we just would look at people like, nobody's capable of doing that in this room, Coach. You can just take that off the tape.
You made my day, Bobby. That's a cool story, man. I think you shared that with me before, but yeah, you know what? I didn't know any better, Bobby. That stun and separate technique. That's the only reason I lasted as long as I did in the NFL, man.
So, all right. So here's where I want to start, guys. I want to start with, you know, obviously some of the news that's happening now, And I want to start with Tim Tebow, but I want to kind of like take a different angle with you guys here, because I just, you know, one of the first things that I got back from somebody in the aftermath of the news yesterday, and we're recording this on Tuesday, was just kind of like how Urban may have opened a can of worms for himself here in bringing in Tim Tebow, and how like there are probably former players of his that might take this a certain way and might look at this a certain way and might start calling him and asking him for a job. Let me start here with both of you guys as former players. When you first heard the news that a guy who hasn't been in a, you know, in an actual game in 9 years, who hasn't been in a training camp in 6 years, and who isn't going to play the position that he played exclusively, you know, as a collegiate and in the pros, what was the first thing that popped in your head?
You know, I'll go, Bobby. I think for, you know, for me, it was here we go with Urban Meyer. You know, I mean, there's something about Urban Meyer where you kind of think, you know, the college coach going into the NFL, you know, he has to be very careful about doing college things and playing, if it's playing favorites, if it's being more political. And Urban Meyer, we know, is a very stubborn guy, and I think it's his way or the highway kind of guy. And we've seen college coaches that come in the NFL that kind of coach that way, and more times than not, you know, Bert and Bobby, I think it doesn't work. And so Nick Saban is probably an example of kind of that not working out in Miami. So when you sign a guy like Tebow, who hasn't been in the league for the last whatever, he hasn't played in a football game since 2012, he's almost 34 years old, and he's playing a position he's never played, that is not going to go over well in the locker room. And so there's already been some questionable decisions that Urban Meyer's already done earlier this offseason that I think guys are going to kind of like roll their eyes with. So he has to be very, very careful. My thing is, Bobby and you guys and Bert, is that he's in Jacksonville, Florida, you know, the head coach of a team in a city that's not too dissimilar to, oh, I don't know, Tallahassee, Florida, Happy Valley, Pennsylvania, College Station, Texas, Columbus, Ohio, in the sense that it has more of a college feel to it. And so I think thinks he can get away with doing college-type football things as a head coach in the NFL because of where he's at in Jacksonville. It's very much a collegiate town more than it is a pro town. So I feel like he feels, you know what, I can do what I want to do down here and it's going to be okay. I just worry that the guys on that team, he might lose them because of decisions like this and signing a Tim Tebow who hasn't been in the league and hasn't played the position of tight end ever in his life.
Bobby?
And so, you know, full disclosure, I talked to Urban on Saturday night. He was back in Columbus. And, you know, I was very impressed. I was curious if he was going to have success in the NFL. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think he has changed a little bit the way that he coaches. He has a really good staff. I think he has a nice mix of college and NFL guys when he's kind of assimilated them together and creating the culture that he wants, you know, with the staff. I think they did a pretty good job in the draft. I guess the biggest concern for me, you know, it's similar, you know, to what Ted said. It's not the fact that you're bringing in one of your former players and you're giving a guy a shot. It's the last time he played, Albert, was the same season I played. And I look at that and I'm like, okay, he's a little younger than I am. Like, I'm 38. I work out every day. I can still run. Thankfully, my knees are still in pretty good shape. So I can still move a little bit. I was sitting there talking to my wife about this last night. She knows football pretty well. And she's like, I don't see why the big deal. Like, Tim's in good shape. Like, physically, I think he could be able to handle it. But as I could sit here and tell you, like, the position-specific skills that you have to develop over the course of your life, like, you have no idea how hard it is. Playing quarterback is wholly unique. You don't touch another human being. They're going to ask him to either be an H-back or be an inline tight end and get up and block a guy on the end of line of scrimmage. And I don't think that he could block either one of us right now. And I don't think that he could shake me in coverage at this point. I mean, he's like a 4.7 guy, and that was when he was younger. And so I look at this, like, he physically, he looks the part, but just the skills, and he'll work out fine. And he's a grinder, he's tough, and all those things. He's a great human being. I just don't see what he's going to be able to add to the team. Like, he doesn't have the skills. It would be no different Then if you took Jason Witten, who's a Hall of Fame tight end and one of the best all time, say, Witt, you know, we're going to bring you in for quarterback. You know, we think that you've been able to do this. You know, you were really good. You know offense, but it's a completely different set of skills, you know, with hand placement and all of these different things. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing I look at. Like, it took me a year and a half in the NFL to really get my hands to where they needed to be at a position that I had been playing my entire life.
Do you?
Here's the thing, just to jump in real quick, is – What Tim Tebow is going to face is not an easy working kind of conditions, and in the sense that there are going to be guys, they're going to be out to kind of get him. You know, if Tim Tebow is his job on a certain play is to block me on the end of the line, Tim Tebow is not blocking me if I'm a defensive end. There's going to be this kind of feeling like, you know, I can't believe this guy's out here and he's really trying to block me. And a guy that's never played this position who has been out of the game for this long, and I think it's going to be tough. I think it's going to be really, really tough. And then, you know, you read things about, you know, Urban maybe bringing him in because of his fire, because of his commitment, because of his leadership. You know, that those are things that you have to be so you got to bring something more to the table than just the intangibles at this point. Guys aren't going to care about the fact that he won two national championships in Florida many, many years ago. So he's going to have a very difficult time, I think, just being accepted in that group because it's going to be perceived. I know you guys are Urban Meyer guys, that he's a teacher's pet, and that doesn't usually go well in an NFL locker room.
No, hey, believe me, Ted, I'm on board with you and everything that you're saying with that. And that's why I don't think it's going to work. If he wanted to do this in 2012 – if instead of going to Ohio State, Urban goes to Jacksonville at that point, he's just getting, you know, he's played 5-6 years and you try to make a pivot or a transition, I think guys might look at that a little bit differently. But the fact that he hasn't played football in 8 years, I mean, how hard that's going to be. The guys in the locker room, they're going to, you got guys in there are 22, 23 years old in the prime of their lives, and they've been working on this for a long time. Like Ted said, they're not going to take kindly to someone out there trying to do it for the first time. Defensive ends, outside linebackers, those guys are going to try to destroy him. And frankly, like I said, physically, he's strong enough to do it. But the skill that it takes for these guys that have been working on it for the last 15, 20 years of their lives, like you can't overcome that in an offseason.
And it's like, I would think like, and to me, what popped in my head when you said what you said, Ted, was like, there's a fine line between being the guy everybody like looks up to, or the guy everybody kind of like looks at as the standard, and being a practice hero, right? Like, isn't there like you have to, don't you? You have to at least like bring something to the team before you have the credibility as a player for what, like where what you're doing is going to rub off on anybody else. Is that a fair way to look at it, Bobby? Like, you have to be doing something. Like, you have to be capable of doing something for the team. Like, to go from just a guy who's like practice hero to a guy who is like, all right, like this guy's rubbing off on everybody else.
Yeah. Your best, the Urban, one of the things he always talked about, and they have in the weight room at Ohio State, like your best players have to be your best grinders or your best leaders. It's not the other way around. And so it needs to be guys at the top. Tim can't be, you know, in the offseason you have 90 guys. He can't be the 85th guy on the roster and be leading. No one's going to follow that. Like that's the difference there. Like, you can't be that person unless you're providing, like Ted said, some tangible value to the team where people look at this and say, okay, you know, this guy can do the A, he can do B, and he's really, really good at his job. And by the way, he does it all the right way, works his butt off, and does all the things the team asks him to do.
And with the beauty of, you know, the NFL, I think if you ask guys in the NFL what they think about Tim Tebow, my feeling is most guys would say, kind of agree with what Bobby and I are saying. It's not a good look. They would question it. They would be a little bit critical, I think, of that move. And the thing that you got to realize is guys just want to win football. Can Tim Tebow help them win a football game? That's what we most want, is that how can we look good and play good so that we get paid? And can we win football games? And I'm not so sure. I just don't see – those guys aren't going to think that maybe Tim Tebow is going to help them win football games. So that's the problem number one. And then I would say one of the things that I think is going on here, you guys, is – and I thought this back when Tim Tebow was in the Patriots training camp. I don't know how long ago that was. 8 years ago?
Yeah.
My feeling was back then, you guys, was that Bill Belichick was doing Urban Meyer a solid by having Tim on the roster. Why? because Tim Tebow's played 3 years in the NFL. He needs to be on an active roster for just three more games to get a vested season, to become fully vested and get lifetime benefits. So my feeling is this is Urban Meyer doing a solid for his buddy. You have him on the roster for just three games. Now he's got four credited seasons. Now he has lifetime benefits. To me, that's him kind of taking care of Tim. That's a side thing. And that's what I look at it. You can be skeptical, but that's kind of how I feel that maybe he's going on.
That's a fascinating point, though, isn't it? Like, that's sort of like, that's a really, like, I don't know. I don't think most people would, like, kind of, like, dig into that. That, Bobby, that's kind of an interesting point, you know?
It is. It's very cynical by Ted, but it's not, doesn't mean that it's not true. No, but it is, I'm with you because you know guys who, you're going into your fourth year, and there's so many guys like, hey, just got to make the team, get through the first couple games, and then you get set up with a lot of things in your life to be able to, with your retirement and everything else moving forward. And I'm glad you brought up, Ted, the fact he played for the Patriots. He played for the Jets. It wasn't like he had a one stop in Denver and it didn't work. Like, there were other smart coaches. You know, Tony Sperano's up there with the Jets. You know, he helped, you know, helped start the Wildcat phenomenon down in Miami. You know, he's up with Bill Belichick, one of the most creative coaches you're going to find. It. And it didn't work then when he was really in the prime of his life. And so now at 33, 34 years old, like, I just don't see it working at this point in time.
How do players view the circus that comes with it? Because I think, like, I guess you sort of dealt with that, Bobby, with T.O. And like, Dallas,
yeah, T.O. is a Hall of he's a Hall of Famer. It's like Ted said, like, you're bringing other value to the table. So you're gonna go out there and have 8 catches for 140 and 2 TDs. Like, all right, there's a lot of nonsense going on, but you're adding value. And that's the thing with Tim. Like, you're not adding the value that people will look at and say it justifies everything else. Like, you can handle that stuff and you're great. You know, Ted played with Terry Glenn. You know, he's a little bit of a different dude too. I was with him in Dallas, but you know what? When Terry would go out there, Terry was tough as nails. He'd go catch everything, and he was really damn good on the football field.
He was.
Right. So let me ask you guys this. Let me ask you this then, because Ted sort of touched on this before. Bobby, do you think there's a risk to Urban's credibility with the locker room bringing him in? Like, do you think that it's like, if you are trying to sell the best players are going to be here, this is a meritocracy, I'm going to promote competition, like, and like, I don't know, for lack of a better way of putting it, maybe some guys view it as like Tebow's on scholarship here, you know? Like, do you think that there's any sort of risk to credibility, or do you think it's just, all right, well, if it doesn't work out in a few weeks, we're all going to forget about it a month after that?
I think if it doesn't work out in a few weeks or even during training camp, we'll all forget about it. If he somehow gets on the 53-man roster, then I think there will be a healthy degree of cynicism, and there should be, because I can't foresee a way that they would not be able to have two or three tight ends or H-backs, whatever you want. You couldn't justify, I think, that he'll be one of the best 53.
Okay. All right. Well, last thing on this then. What would happen if you guys went to training camp?
Oh, dude. I'm trying to think. There was a quarterback for A&M. You remember Bert back in the day who played special teams for the Oilers, and then he came. What was his name? He was a quarterback, and I can't remember his name. Dang it! But he played fullback, and Parcells brought him in to play fullback. He was drafted by the Houston Oilers. Anyway, I can't remember his name. It'll come to me, I'm sure, but. I remember when he came to the Patriots, and he was a guy that, again, played collegiately as a quarterback, came to the NFL, and Parcells tried to turn him into a fullback, and I'm going up against him in training camp, and I am like, I'm trying to destroy this guy, Bobby, taking on lead draws and ace ices, and I'm trying to, because there's no way as a linebacker I'm going to let a former quarterback embarrass me in training camp. Or, you know, and so to me, guys are going to really be teed up when they go against Tim Tebow because of the fact they feel like, well, he's a favorite of Urban Meyer, that he doesn't deserve the roster spot, that he's taken someone else's job, that he's really not in a tangible way going to maybe help this football team. And so guys are going to almost take it personal. And I hate to say it that way, but I can understand, that's probably going to be a dynamic in training camp that you probably need to look for. I find this to be a fascinating storyline. In fact, I find just Urban Meyer getting into the NFL a fascinating storyline. And I like that he's in Jacksonville, because he feels in Jacksonville, I think what Urban feels like is he's safe to be kind of the same guy he was in college, that he can control the media there. that they love him there already for because of the success he had when he was the college coach there. And so he's not going to face a lot of criticism from the media or the fans with the Tebow decision unless he's on the team and they're doing bad. That's when it'll really start coming down on him. He has to be careful.
You know, Bobby, was there ever a player that you guys saw in training camp that you wanted to kind of test, like where it was like that, like with Ted's story about like a quarterback moving over to fullback, or maybe a guy was hyped, or maybe a guy came in and with a little too much swagger and you wanted to take him down a notch or test him? Like, that's got to be fairly common, right?
Yeah, there's always guys. I mean, and this is the situation. I had just left Dallas. Dez Bryant was a little bit like that, but he could back it up with his play. And that's the one thing, Ted, right, we keep going back to. Back it up with your play. It's cool. Guys will handle all the crazy stuff. There was a receiver that we drafted in Detroit my second year there. Titus Young. Oh, he was like Titus Young.
Yeah.
And he could actually play, but this dude was a weirdo. He's gotten in a lot of trouble since then.
There was a lot of like,
but
stuff
like the
him.
Dude, he like thought he was better than Calvin Johnson. And I'm like, dude, this guy is one of the best receiver, best players I've ever seen in my life. Best athletes. And he was complaining. And this is the honest truth. Like the second or third, fourth game of the year, somewhere early in the season, he actually tried, we're in a 2-minute drill, and he tried to switch and go take the X from Calvin during the game. Like Stan Jefferson, who was our receivers coach,
yep,
who played a long time in the league, like afterwards in the locker room.
Oh, Sean Jefferson, who would have played Jefferson, with Ted.
Sean Jefferson played with Ted,
yeah.
Oh, dude, Sean was about ready to fight him. He was about ready to fight him in the locker room because he goes, what are you doing? He goes, man, I wasn't going to get the ball over at, you know, whatever position I was. So he went over to the X, and Calvin just acquiesced because he's a great guy and didn't want to get a penalty. Like, dude, guys used to abuse him in practice. The DBs, linebackers, like, you always, he catch the ball and you just knock him down as he's running back. Cause it was like, dude, you're a good player, but you're not him. Like, you can be fine, work your way through it. There's so many guys come in and just think they're the greatest now. Ted was at the end of it. It is even crazier now, like, with how the expectations of guys coming in and just think they've arrived. And like, dude, you're playing with grown men. This isn't college anymore.
It's totally different, Bobby. And we can get sidetracked on this, Robert, because I have all kinds of thoughts on that. Today's athlete, they don't respect the NFL like I think our generation, the generation before. I mean, I see guys come into training camp for high draft picks, and they don't pass the conditioning test. It's like, I see it all the time. I used to see it when I covered the Texans. I've seen it, you know, you hear about it here in New England, where it's, so don't get me started on that, but Bobby's absolutely right. Today's athlete is usually, more times than not, they don't respect the game as much as I think guys that came before us.
But okay,
I'm going to get off my lawn guy right now. So.
All right. Yeah, and that's going to be a separate podcast. I'm all in for bashing younger people and bashing like Generation Z. So we'll put together like a separate podcast for that. The last thing on the Tebow thing. Do you guys think that you could make it through a training camp practice right now today?
Well, yeah, one practice. It's never the practice.
It's not one, right?
It's the waking up the day after. 3 years ago, whatever, I practiced Ohio State and did some bowl practice with them. I did 3 days. First day, great. Second day, ate about 4 ibuprofen. The third day, like, I had to get in the hot tub for like a half an hour. I mean, it was brutal. I'm like, there's no way I could do this for an entire season. Like, if you managed it, maybe, but you play a game, you would literally be just dragging out until the next Friday before you could do anything again. That's where it is. It's the recovery.
I think I could last like a week, believe it or not, because they don't have 2 days anymore. And every third day they get off training camp. So, you know, like, yeah, I can maybe last a week, and then I would bow because I'm just too old and too many things would fall apart. But the conditions at training camp, you see, here's the thing about the training camp now is a lot of times football, they would test you to see how tough you were. Like, who was still standing after the fourth day of consecutive two-a-days and physical 9-on-7 and all, you know, these drills, who was still left standing? And you could evaluate guys on toughness back in the day, you know, before 2011. Now you that element of kind of testing guys and evaluating guys' toughness is out the door because of the new rules. So it's very hard. It's just, you know, guys come out of training camp feeling better than they ever have since the time that Bobby and I played. So
yeah, there's not like the weeding out. It used to be almost like weeding out, right?
Right.
I forgot about that because that did happen my last couple of years. And I'm like, man, Ted, if this would have been the case my whole career, I would have felt great the whole time. Like, right? Parcells, this is no joke. We just started the first day in pads, and I guarantee you it's the same story for Ted. Our first team period was short yardage goal line. Like, I thought it was a joke. I'm like, am I back in high school? And they're like, nope, this is – like, why are we putting this in right now? Not base defense, first down, short yardage goal line, live to the ground tackle. Like, who's tougher? Are we going to stop them? Are we going to let them score? It was crazy.
I believe it's true. And I think now – I think you have five practices in shorts before you even get to pad. So it's very much a different game now.
Yeah, I'm assuming – like, so for those who don't know – Bobby and Ted were brought into the league by the same guy. So they probably have a lot of stories. They probably have a lot of stories that match up with one another.
Yep.
Both Bill Parcells guys. So I want to hit a couple other things before we get you guys out of here. And the next thing's like sort of the Rodgers thing and kind of, you know, where this is right now and, you know, his willingness to show up to the offseason program. And I think we probably won't see him at least until training camp. If you're the Packers, if you're Matt LaFleur or you're Brian Gutekunst, how do you handle this? Because the more I look at this guys, the more I look at their roster, and it's a lot of guys that are in the heart of their prime, you know, like David Bakhtiari and Davante Adams and Za'Darius Smith and Preston Smith and Adrian Amos and Jair Alexander and Kenny Clark. And you look at like up and down the line, it's like a bunch of guys that are right in the heart of their prime. And they've been in the championship game 2 years in a row. And you know, obviously the communication, I think, has been an issue between Rodgers and the team. And, like, so if you're the GM or the coach, like, what do you do now? Like how would you handle this?
Go ahead, Bobby.
I guess it's really tough. And I have to detach myself a little bit from knowing Aaron somewhat because I love the guy and I think he's phenomenal. You know, the last 10 years, the only offensive player you've taken in the first round is the guy you drafted to replace him. You know, you have a pretty good roster. I think he's upset with the fact that he's beginning to stare down the barrel of time and he watched what Tom Brady did in Tampa and he's thinking, why are we not being ultra aggressive trying to add talent? We're right on the cusp. We got there. We lost to San Fran. We got there. We lost to Tampa Bay. Why can't we try to push this thing over the top and you're trying to prepare for the future? Whereas guys get laid in their career, they don't care about the future. Like, I'm trying to win today. Forget about next year, 5 years from now. I'm trying to win now. And I think that's the biggest rub that Aaron's had. He's been in Green Bay, a place that a lot of guys don't like to live in the offseason. They don't necessarily want to be there. It's not the most glamorous place in the world. He's embraced the city. He's embodied everything that's been about it. You know, I don't think he got along with McCarthy all that well. He's in a situation now where I think that him and LaFleur get along reasonably well, but I think he's at his wit's end. He sees some of these other guys like Stafford's leaving Detroit and going to LA. And I think all of a sudden he's like, man, it's not even the location. It's just, I want to go to a team where I feel like they're all invested in winning with me for the next 3 or 4 years. And you see Tom Brady do it. You see Matt Stafford do it. I think that that's the biggest thing. So I honestly believe that he might try to Carson Palmer this thing and just sit out. And I think he's trying to balance it because he loves Green Bay. He loves the fan base and how collegiate it is up there. And he doesn't want to ruin his reputation with it all, but they're kind of treating him like Brett Favre, and Favre was oscillating back and forth every year. So you've got to try to plan for the future. Aaron's been nothing but committed, showed up, done everything they asked. And so that's why I think he's going to stay firm on this. And I think you have to eventually take the best package you can get for him, because you can't go into your camp and have your starting MVP quarterback not there.
Yeah, look, I think the best thing for both sides is that you part ways, and I think the sooner the better, quite honestly, because you know what, probably at the end of the day, it's probably what Aaron wants is to get a fresh start, and I think it would be in the best interest of the Green Bay Packers to get a fresh start, because I think there's just too much underlying stuff there, right? I mean, look, you look at a lot of these quarterback situations. I think in Seattle with Russell Wilson, I think that thing's broke. Yeah, can they mend fences? Can they make it work? Yeah, and they're going to have to, I'm sure, this year. But there's always going to be this underlying unresolved issue between Russell Wilson and the Seahawks until they eventually part ways. And I think the same thing with Aaron is that there's always going to be this underlying issue, distrust. They're not going to trust each other. And so you cannot win a championship when you have distrust between a franchise quarterback and the organization. I would think they need to cut bait right now, because I think Aaron, that's what he ultimately wants, is a new start. And I think the Green Bay Packers would be wise to do that, because if they acquiesce, I don't know if he wants more money. I don't know if it's what he wants, more power. But at this point, I think it would best serve both entities if they were to cut bait and move on at this point.
I thought Bobby brought up a great point there, because I do think like athletes are more cognizant of what's going on around them than ever before. And there's a big part of that, Bobby. When I watched that press conference after the NFC Championship game, like he's looking around and he saw the Bills go and get Stephon Diggs for Josh Allen. He saw the way the Chiefs have built around Patrick Mahomes, and he sees like the Bucks mortgaging contract after contract. And like, you look at the way the Bucks built, to me, like it's like 2023, we'll worry about that when we get there. You know what I mean? Like, we're not concerned about that. Like, because we have Tom Brady today, and we don't know if he's going to be around in a year or two, but we're going to do the best we can to build around him right now. Like, so, like, how much of this, like, do you guys think is, you know, just athletes being cognizant of A, what they're up against, and B, the sorts of, like, conditions that maybe guys are going up against are in?
I see, you mentioned Brady. I think Brady screwed it all up for. I think Brady is basically like,
because it worked. It wasn't just that he did it, because it worked.
It worked. Dude, you got Russell Wilson at the Super Bowl with his wife next to the commissioner, and everybody, and he's sitting there watching Tom, like, Tom just switched teams, pretty much got to bring in whoever he wanted, got paid what he wanted. He's got power, and he's got all these businesses off field. And he's in the biggest game and he wins the whole thing. It's like they all want what Tom has. And so now, obviously Aaron fancies himself in the same category as Tom, even though hasn't come close to winning as many Super Bowls, but he still, he feels like he's in that same, degree of ability. And so he wants the same amount of power and probably liberties that's been extended to Tom in Tampa Bay, in Green Bay. And, the Green Bay organization, it's just, they're not going to do that. It's a totally different deal. And so he probably sees what happened with their Tom in Tampa Bay. And he's like, that's what I want. And Green Bay is not going to create a work environment like Tom has down there in Tampa Bay.
And we can leave the Aaron topic with this. Like, this goes back to Favre. And remember, the biggest riff with him that's happened in Green Bay was when they passed on bringing in Randy Moss. Mm-hmm. And he goes to New England and all of a sudden blows it up, and Brett is furious. And Aaron's probably looking at this because, he's there. He's seeing it happen in real time. And when you're a young player, you don't understand it as much. Now he's looking back on and saying, they didn't do it for this guy who's one of the best. I just won the MVP. They're not doing it for me. Like, it may be time for me to try to get out of here before I'm like Brett and a little bit too old. I can do this right now and have a chance to go get a ring.
What do you think's missing, though? I mean, I don't know. It's like, I don't know what Aaron, like, what he's got, one of the best receivers in the league. He's got.
Well, so here it is, though, Ted. Like, to me, like, I think this is a nuance to the Buccaneers thing that, like, a lot of people didn't realize. Do you know all their touchdowns were scored in the Super Bowl? All their touchdowns were scored by guys who were acquired after Brady.
Yep.
Like, that's an amazing fact. When you look at all the talent they already had there, whether it's Evans, Howard, Brait, Godwin, like all the guys they had there to begin with, right? And they still, like, their touchdowns were scored by Antonio Brown, Rob Gronkowski, and Leonard Fournette. Like, all the score. Like, so I think that's, like, sort of something that, like, I'm sure Aaron Rodgers looks at. Yeah. Like, yeah, I like what I've got with me. But, like, in a game, like, we're in a level now where the margins are like this. We have to win on the margins.
Yep.
Like, I need you to start to do things on the margins that are going to get me a little extra. At least that's my read on it. Yeah. All right, so a couple last things, guys. Number one, I want to get your take on the importance of off-season programs. Obviously, this has been a big fight between the union and the league over the course of the last couple of months. The union's trying to get players to skip out. I think it's a really tough sell if I'm anybody but a star player, right? Like, the idea you could lose playing time, the idea you could lose your job, the idea somebody's getting in front of you. I just think the NFL is too damn competitive on a player-for-player basis for guys to say, unless everyone's not showing up, like, I'm going to take a stand and not show up. So you guys were in the league for a long time. Like, how important do you think the months of April and May and June are? And do you sympathize with the guys who are having to make that decision now based on the fight between the union and the league?
You know, I think it's tough because every player, their personal life and their situation is going to be different. For me, I mean, if you want to do 2 weeks OTAs, I'm fine with that. I didn't really want to be necessarily where I was playing the entirety of the year. I like to come back. I like to be around my family. And frankly, I was going to get my butt up in the morning. I was going to go work out. I was going to be accountable and responsible to myself. And so as they started tempering back, you know, the expectations, the offseason, like, great, dude, these guys, they go be turds. Like, and here's the one thing that really bothers me about, you know, talking about working out away from the facility. And they're like, oh, if you're not here and you get hurt, you're not going to get paid. Well, you get done with mini camp or OTAs in mid-June. You have a month and a half, basically 5 weeks or so till training camp. So you're telling me if guys get hurt at that point in time, like training, you're not going to pay them? Like, it drives me crazy. Like, what do you expect them to do? And so I understand you want them there. You want to be able to do things because coaches especially love, you know, all powerful control, and they want to govern, especially college guys, every part of your life. But if you draft high quality humans who are going to be in shape and show up and work out and they care about what they do, you don't have to worry about those guys. So bring them in for a couple of weeks, do, you know, six to 10 OTAs, maybe a little mini camp in there, and let them go. If you want to have stuff available for guys, have it available. But the problem is the voluntary has turned into mandatory. And because right. You're going to be penalized if you're not there. And that's the biggest problem. Then the beef that I have with it. And then when a guy gets hurt, it's not like the dude was out skiing or doing something ridiculous. You tear your Achilles and you're running on a football field. Like, the guy's trying to get better for you to be the best that he can be. Like, that doesn't make any sense to me.
This story to me it frustrates me beyond anything. And it's always been this dynamic. The NFLPA just negotiated a new CBA. They decided on what their rules were going to be for the players in that league. And they have had this voluntary kind of off-season workout program ever since Bobby and I played into now, where it's kind of this gray area where it's like it's voluntary, but certain teams, I'll tell you, if you don't show up for voluntary workouts in the off-season for the Patriots, you will pay the price. Belichick, and I can speak to that personally. It is not voluntary in most coaches' eyes. You better be there. But the NFLPA needs to clearly negotiate that so there's no more gray area. So it's like some guys, if the star players can work out on their own, but the last guy on the bench can't, it to me, they need to be uniform in the offseason. And they had a chance to negotiate that less than a year ago, and they didn't. They left it like it's always been, where the offseason training is a voluntary thing. And I just don't think that's smart to do. I will say this at the end of the day, I get what the players are doing. You know, they're using maybe the COVID as a way to kind of, you know, give some more leverage in this. But I think it's a little bit grandstanding, and it sounds a little hollow when there's so many other things that our union should be worrying about and focused on, and that they had a chance less than a year ago to negotiate. You know, where the offseason, you don't have to be there. They didn't do that. They left it the way it is. And so there's gray area there. And so I think they get what they deserve when it comes to this. I do.
So I'm putting what you guys are saying together, and it's almost like you'd rather, as a player, have had like a 3-week mandatory spring camp rather than like a 9-week, quote-unquote, voluntary camp that really isn't voluntary. Is that right? That would have been better for you guys, right?
I would have preferred that. Just make it mandatory. And if you want to extend it longer than just what mini camp is, which is 3 days, no problem. You know, a mandatory 3-week off season, that would be fine with me, but make it clear and concise. So, you know, it's not like, so you don't have to, you know, figure out if your job's going to be on the line if you don't show up for voluntary workouts. Make it mandatory, so I know for a fact I got to be there.
Okay. Last thing, and we're going to finish. Go ahead.
Well, just quickly with that, the reason why guys don't want to be there, some of these facilities are trash. Like, New England has a nice facility, but a lot of guys, like, you go there, they don't take care of you. They don't have good food. They don't have good places to work out. And so you're like, why do I want to spend more time here? So like Ted said, tighten it up to 3 weeks, have everything else just open weight room availability, and they're not allowed to take attendance. Guys want to come. They come when they come. If not, you go back to where else you live, and you work out there, and you show up in shape. And if you're a turd when you show up, well, then you're going to get your butt cut.
That's not a bad idea. I mean, like, you do it in May and June, and that way the NFL gets its content, which is what they want, right? Like, so you get that in May and June, and you're taken care of. All right, last thing, and we'll finish where we started here. Since you guys are both defensive guys, and I don't know that I've done, like, a panel yet with, like, exclusively defensive guys, I want to ask you guys just kind of, like, about the state of the game. And it really jumped out at me, you know, over draft weekend where – you know, like, you see the number of offensive players going high, and you see the number of receivers, and you see, like, some of the depth issues at corner. And I even, like, you know, like, somebody brought up to me how, like, a lot of the corners this year were sons of players, right? Like, where the play, like, they're like, their dads are saying to them, like, you should play corner because there are less of these out there. And, like, JC Horn's, Joe Horn's kid, Pat Surtain's kid's going high. You know, Molden, he was a player's son, Asante Samuel Jr. So, like, and you look at it, and then it crystallizes with the first 15 picks. There are only three defensive players in there: JC Horn, Patrick Surtain, and Micah Parsons. Like, how much is this, like, just where football is? And I know you guys do follow the game at the lower levels, and, you know, Bobby, your dad was a high school coach forever. Is this just where the game's going? Like, as two guys who, you know, made your money on defense, like, is this just not going to be stopped? You know what I mean? Like, is this just going to kind of, is the boulder kind of rolling down the hill on this?
Well, most teams invest less on defense than they do on offense right now. You get a great quarterback, you surround him with talent, you have your defense that can kind of hold on. And so what are the positions you need? Guys that can impact that quarterback. Elite edge pass rushers that we've seen have a massive impact. Those guys go really high. Corners going to go really high. Safeties have kind of been devalued unless you're really versatile. Off the ball linebackers like Ted and I, basically dinosaurs. Like, unless you got to make sure you can play all three downs. You saw Micah Parsons go high because he's a guy that can provide in the rush game and he's really good in coverage. But I do think there will be a little swing back. I don't know if these guys will get drafted really high, but if you go look at the Bucs, how they won their Super Bowl, they don't have a great secondary. They have really good pass rushers, and they had two elite inside linebackers in Lavonte David and Devin White. And those guys, they said, pass rushers, go take care of Pat Mahomes. Hey, White and David, try to lock down their tight end, take care of Andy Reid's 37,000 screens that he's going to run at you, and take care of the run game. And we'll just get really deep and not let them throw the ball over our head. And that was Bowles' game plan. And it was beautiful. It was beautiful, but they just, it's not the running game anymore that you have to be worried about. If you're a linebacker, like, you've got to be have an elite skill set to be able to get drafted high. So essentially you're looking at really corners and defensive ends or an elite D tackle are really the only guys that have the ability to get in the first round anymore.
I find it interesting, you guys, that I always thought it was the other way around for so long, that the NFL, it's a trickle-down effect. The NFL is going to impact the college game, and that more college teams were going to try to kind of implement what the NFL is doing so that more guys could get drafted. It's the other way around. I mean, the college game is influencing the NFL game. And so you're seeing a lot of these teams, a lot of these offenses very much having kind of hybrid systems, like the NFL kind of philosophies mixed in with collegiate philosophy. So you're seeing more and more, I think, you had a couple of teams in the top 10 draft wide receivers to match up with the quarterbacks they had in college. So it's more of a passing game than it's ever been. The influence of college on the NFL game is more evident. It's never been more evident than it is right now. And I think maybe to highlight what Bobby's saying, I'll put it this way. So my last year in the NFL was 2004. And I played every snap. It was 50% of the snaps of our base defense, okay? And I, like Bobby, was what you call, like, you know, the prototype middle linebacker, run stoppers. I would come off on third down, and so they'd put in a guy that was maybe a little bit better equipped to cover the pass. But I played 50% of the snaps in the NFL in 2005 as a base Mike linebacker in 3-4. Today, I would maybe see the field 20% of the time. My snaps would decrease big time. So the game is not fighting in a phone booth anymore. It's not about who's tougher, who's bigger, stronger, who wants it more. It's about space, athleticism, and scheme. That's what it's totally become now. And so it's not about who's tougher. It's not about who's got more will, who's going to be, you know, standing still, still standing at the end of this game after a bloodbath of a game. It's not like that anymore. It's more of a finesse, space, scheme game than it's ever been. And you're seeing influences in that. And that's where they want to go more offense. It's more geared for offense. So I'm not surprised less defensive, players are getting drafted because of all the rules being bent more towards offense and the influx of college kind of influences, if you will.
And I'll leave you with this here, Albert, and this goes, I'll drop another Parcellism in there for you. His thing was you can only draft the players that the college game gives you. And so college game right now, very little defense being played. It's a wide open style. Like you're not going to be able to find guys. Belichick kind of goes counterculture with that, but it's tough to be able to find guys if you want to play a different way.
No question. All right. And this was great, guys. I feel like we got like a half dozen other podcasts we could do off of this. So I appreciate you coming out. He's Bobby Carpenter, former first round pick, former Cowboy, Lion, Dolphin, and Patriot, and Ohio State Buckeye. And so I got to put your alma mater in there too, Ted.
And
he's Ted Johnson, former Colorado Buffalo, second round pick and expatriate, three-time Super Bowl champion. Guys, this was awesome. I really appreciate you coming out.
Hey, and also, we're also Parcells guys. And so that's a
– Exactly.
I want that on my resume too. So, hey, it's good seeing you, Bobby. And Bert, we'll see you, buddy. All right?
All right, thanks, guys.
All right, see ya.
All right, thanks to Ted. Thanks to Bobby. That was fantastic. We'll jump right into the six-pack. You guys know how this works. Every week on Tuesday, I put the call out for questions on Twitter. If I pick six, if I pick yours, you get an answer here on the podcast, and you get a like on Twitter. That means I hit that little heart button. If I don't get to you here, chances are I might have gotten to you in the mailbag. That'll go up on Wednesday on the MMQB.com as well. First question of the week from Jeremy Fredericks. That's at FredericksJK. Hi, Albert. What are your thoughts on a second-year breakout player from each conference? Thank you. So I'm going to give you in the AFC, Jeremy, Kenneth Murray, the linebacker from the Chargers. I really believe in what Brandon Staley is going to do defensively for the Chargers. And there are so many good players around Kenneth Murray that I could see as the nerve center of Brandon Staley's new defense. You could see him having like the sort of playing like the sort of like the Roquan Smith in Chicago role there. So I really see him kind of being the nerve center of that defense and a guy who I think could really burst onto the scene with a Pro Bowl type of year in year two. And in the other conference in the NFC, I'm going to give you Van Jefferson, who I think part of the Rams, you know, like operating this year and like what they're doing on offense, it's going to open up more opportunities for the receivers, especially guys like Van who can threaten on different levels of the field. And I just look at it like there was a point of the offseason where I actually had sniffed around at the idea, hey, maybe the Rams to get some salary cap relief could trade Robert Woods. Now, it was never going to happen. It was more teams asking about Woods than it was, Woods actually truly being available. But one thing I was able to pick up along the way was that the Rams really did feel good about where Van Jefferson was. And this is before they drafted Tutu Atwell. So give you Jefferson for the AFC or for the NFC, Murray for the AFC. And I'm doing that saying like, I mean, they're the obvious guys like that were really good last year, that could be great this year. I'm disqualifying them from the conversation. So if you want one of those, I guess Jonathan Taylor would be the guy for me who I think could wind up winning the rushing title in Indianapolis. Question number two, this is from Zach Fogelman. That's at Fogelman. Zach, is Cleveland Kansas City's biggest threat in the AFC? Do you think that the Browns will be a top two seed in the AFC and win the AFC North? Are they Super Bowl contenders? They are stacked all over. Zach, you are right. And I'll tell you this, you look at their roster, they're starting to build ahead. Like they're starting to build, you know, into spots where they maybe need some depth. And so, you know, going and getting Greg Newsome and Jeremiah Owusu-Koramoah, first two rounds of the draft, I mean, there were needs at those positions, but it's not like they're overly weak. And I think that tells you where they're at from a roster standpoint. So I think Cleveland is certainly in the mix. And they're well-rounded enough now where I think you can say how the quarterback comes along and the steps that Baker Mayfield is able to take in 2021 are going to dictate where the ceiling is. So I would say that the Browns are right there. I still think Baltimore, I mean, to me, like that team and what they've been the last couple of years and, you know, where they are when they're at their best. And I think the way that Eric DaCosta builds that team, the way John Harbaugh coaches it, Yeah, like even though they haven't gotten to the championship game and their playoff record the last 2 years has been spotty, last 3 years really has been spotty. Yeah, I think that, you know, if you're knocking on the door enough and you have the kind of well-run operation that the Ravens do, then you're going to be right there. And so I would say, you know, Baltimore's there. Of course, Buffalo's there. So many good young ascending players. But Cleveland's in the mix. If you ask me to single out one, probably still say it's Buffalo just because, you know, you look at their roster and it's like Josh Allen and Tremaine Edmonds and Tre'Davious White and Deion Dawkins and Stephon Diggs. These are all guys that could still get better. Question number three from Taylor Rourke. That's at Time Is After Us. What are internal expectations for the season in Indianapolis with Wentz's first season there and all the pieces they've added this offseason? Taylor, I think that they expect to be right in there with those teams that I've just mentioned and that I just ran through. I really do. They've been building that thing. I mean, for this is going to be Chris Ballard's fifth year there. It's going to be, God, it's hard to believe we're that far along already. But yeah, his fifth year there and Frank Reich's fourth year there. And, you know, the luck thing, of course, set them back a little bit, but the foundation is strong. And if a couple of things happen, like Kwity Paye adds to the pass rush, Eric Fisher gets healthy and can be competent at left tackle, that could be a really good team. Like you said, like a lot still rides on what's going to happen with Carson Wentz and you know, how he looks in a new offense. But I think they have the pieces in place where, again, if a couple things hit, Rocky Sin develops a corner. Kwity Paye becomes an immediate contributor in the pass rush. And Eric Fisher works out at left tackle. I mean, there's a lot of good young talent on that roster. Question number four from Russell Midkiff. That's at RB Midkiff. Did the Bengals do enough to improve their offensive line this offseason? The jury is still out, in my opinion. I'd agree the jury's out. What does Riley Reiff have left? What can Jackson Carmen be? Those, to me, are the two questions that I think you have to answer to figure where you're at in their offensive line. They do have, like, some good pieces. That's the thing about it. Like, Burrow got the crap kicked out of him, and that's because they had some serious holes. But, like, I think when you look at the holes they have, you overstate it, does sort of, like, kind of miss the fact that there are some players in that roster that are, you know, good, young, ascending players, you know, all along the offensive line. And that starts, of course, with Jonah Williams, their left tackle. I think Jonah can be a really, really like a good left tackle in the league for a long time and showed flashes last year in his first year really playing. Trey Hopkins, I think a really good piece at center. Like the way I look at it is, you know, if Jackson Carmen can – like plug right in and play guard, and he's played in big high leverage spots as a collegian, and Riley Reiff still has something left as the right tackle, I actually think they got a chance to be okay and justify the fact that they passed on Penei Sewell and took Ja'Marr Chase with the fifth overall pick. Finally, this is my fifth question, not the sixth, the idiot. Question number five, Michael, that's from at MFiddler02. Will Mac Jones get a legitimate chance to compete for the starting job this summer? If so, and he beats out Cam Newton, what are the chances Cam makes the team? I can't see Cam as a backup. I agree with you on that, Michael. I think if Mac Jones were to win the job coming out of camp, my guess is Cam Newton would probably be gone. Jared Stidham would be the backup. It's hard for me to see Cam in a backup role. And I think, you know, the Patriots would probably do him the favor of letting him go to pursue playing time somewhere else. It'd just be awkward, you know, with a rookie quarterback and wanting to show him that you're behind him. I think it'd be tough to have a former MVP behind him. Now, I don't think it happens. I don't think Mac Jones is going to be the starter coming out of camp. I think Cam Newton's going to be the starter coming out of camp. And I think whether or not Mac Jones gets in the field doesn't just ride on his own development. I think he's pretty ready. You know, that makes it unlike situations in San Francisco and Chicago where think how soon Fields plays, how soon Trey Lance plays. I think that depends on their development. With, you know, New England, I don't think it's Mac Jones' development. I think he's fairly ready to go. It kind of is what he is. I think it more has to do with Cam Newton's play. And so, you know, I don't think Cam Newton's going to have the whole season to prove that he can get back to, you know, what he was a few years ago. You know, but I do think he's probably going to be the starter coming out of camp. So they probably won't face the circumstance you're laying out there, Michael. But if they did, I think it'd be tough to have Cam there as the backup. Finally, question number 6, this is from Not Who You Think I Am. That's at Don Ridenour, our buddy Don Ridenour. Why is it that more ex-players go into coaching versus scouting? As you mentioned, scouting would seem to offer way more freedom for an ex-player. Don, I think it's simple. I think it's the money. Scouting is tough. The lower levels are not very well paid. The equivalent of a position coach in scouting is an area scout. Area scouts aren't paid as well as position coaches. The same way directors aren't paid as well as coordinators. The same way GMs aren't paid as well as head coaches. And so, you know, I think a lot of players get out of football and they don't want to spend the amount of time that it takes to be in either of those realms. I think the hours are a little bit more manageable in scouting than they are in coaching. But, you know, I think the money is a factor. And if you're a player and you're used to making millions of dollars, and now all of a sudden, if you want to get started in scouting, you got to start as a scouting assistant and you're making whatever, 40 or 50 grand, it might be a little bit more difficult to do that than it would be to become a quality control coach and know, well, in a year or two, maybe I'm making 500,000 as a position coach. So I think money's a big part of it. And you know, I think that if you get used to making a certain amount, it can be tough to swallow going all the way back down the totem pole and making a lot less. And we've seen guys do it in coaching and doing it in scouting to make it. You know, Bill O'Brien's a great example of it, who I believe he took about what half his salary was at Duke to go to New England and get in the NFL. And we see where it wound up getting him. I mean, he was head coach in the league for 7 years. So, you know, we see people take less to make it in both scouting and coaching. And it's just harder, I think, for ex-players to reckon with that because they're used to making a lot more money. Appreciate you guys coming out. Always appreciate you guys coming out, and we appreciate your feedback. We want your feedback, and it helps us kind of decide where the show is going and everything else, and we'll have some news on that next week for you. But I'd love to have more feedback for you, and the best place for you guys to do that, of course, is on iTunes, where you can help other people find our show. So leave us a rating, leave us a review there. Again, it really helps us with the algorithms and all that other stuff. And always remember to listen to all the MMQB podcasts, all the SI podcasts, my podcast, the Weekside podcast with Jenny and Connor, of course, the MMQB podcast on Monday mornings. You can find all of us where you can find all your shows at Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, Google Play, Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your programs. We are there. Same time next week. I'll see you guys then.